Hello, I'm Michael Hainsworth. Hospitals are overflowing with patients who may be best served outside an acute care ward, yet they line the hallways across Canada.
As many as 27 out of every 100 patients in an acute care ward would be best served by alternate level care.
Reducing the number of ALC patients would be seen as a win for Canadians. That's according to Rosalie Wanch. In her work for the C.D. Howe Institute, the senior policy analyst writes, in scenarios for seniors' care, future challenges, current gaps, and strategies to address them, that each ALC patient costs Canada's healthcare system anywhere from $730 to $1,200 per day. And with more than 3 million ALC bed days in 2022-23, that unnecessarily costs us as much as $3 billion.
The solution to our long-term care wait lists is not just build more long-term care homes, because that is just more of the status quo, and we'll never have enough of them to actually meet the current demand that we have. And so we need to think about other solutions.
Rosalie joins us now. Thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here, Michael.
What are some of the contributing factors that make an ALC patient a complex health system challenge? Why are people who shouldn't be in acute care taking up a space?
Well, I really think of it as a symptom of sort of the underlying problem. And that is that we have really a gap earlier in the care journey where seniors might not have access to a family doctor. They might not be able to access supportive services. And when they have no other options, they'll end up at a hospital or showing up in an emergency room where they may be admitted into acute care, but there's nowhere for the hospital to send them, and they might require at least some help. And so if that help isn't available, that ends up being where they stay. And beyond that, there are other contributing factors. But realistically, it's really just showing that there is a gap in the continuum of care, and that this gap has real and negative consequences, both for the hospital system, but also for government finances and taxpayers, and for the quality of life of those seniors whose needs could be better met elsewhere and might actually be better met outside of a hospital where they can have access to their communities, social supports, and other activities where in an acute care bed, you are really sort of stuck in that bed.
So tell me about the $3 billion. How did you come up with that?
The government pays a certain amount per day to long-term care operators per bed, as well hospitals have estimated costs of what an acute care bed costs every day. So really it's just the difference between the costs to run an acute care bed, because it is capable of delivering that very high level and intense level of care, compared to a long-term care bed, which is just a lower level of funding from the government. And then that's a low estimate of the excess costs. If we were to actually, support these people before they need these acute services in long-term care, we might actually be able to maintain their independence longer. And the support services related to community and home care are even that much cheaper than long-term care. And so I really see this as a domino effect that, balloons our costs and doesn't serve seniors.
So when it comes to the idea that as many as one out of every four people in an acute care ward really shouldn't be there, I think it's important we point out that you're not suggesting that we reduce acute care bed capacity when we shift an ALC patient out of acute care.
No, absolutely not. Really, I think, we all saw stories during the pandemic about shortages of hospital beds. And what most people might not be aware of is that we still are actually at pretty constant risk of acute care bed shortages. Canada is one of three OECD countries that has an occupancy rate over 85%. Now, there's no agreed upon optimum rate that we necessarily should be targeting, but 85% is generally considered the maximum occupancy that you can have before you have major risk of acute care shortages. And we're one of three countries in that category. and we have the fewest acute care beds per capita in that group. And so absolutely, I'm not suggesting that we should reduce our acute care bed capacity. I actually suggest this is a solution to increase our capacity to meet acute care needs for the rest of the population.
You sort of cited the COVID conundrum and the fact that, you know, we were already at that level before COVID hit. That exacerbated the problem tremendously. Depending on who you talk to, we are out of COVID or we're not. But through the course of that whole experience, one of the things that the nursing community had pointed out to us was it's all well and good that a politician promises more beds, but you need the support staff to make that bed viable. How does that play out in your analysis?
Well, in this analysis, we don't look at labor interactions directly, but I can say for sure that Canada generally has fewer workers in community care than almost any other OECD country, and that it, I would say across the healthcare system, we are still certainly struggling with labor shortages. And so I think this just shows that where something is more care intensive, it's also likely more labor intensive. And so potentially, you know, not that they would, not that nurses would not be employed. Obviously, we would still need just as many if all of those beds are in operation. But I think we need to think about strategies to expand what we consider the supportive labor. If you think about what support policies are, you know, we tend to think about these things as healthcare. But really, a lot of seniors can benefit from supports that just support the activities of daily living. So things like meal delivery services, maybe grocery deliveries, someone to just check in on them, potentially help with laundry or other just sort of daily tasks. And in that sense, there are lots of services that could potentially fill that gap that don't actually require a healthcare worker. You know, a cleaning service doesn't require a nurse. It could be a much lower paid worker, and it's also something that seniors with the means to do so might be able to actually just buy off of the private market to support themselves. However, seniors that are lower income might have more difficulty finding or affording those services.
Tell me more about that in-home and community compare, community care component to all of this. You mentioned that against the OECD, we're near the bottom of the barrel, or at the bottom of the barrel when it comes to the number of acute care beds. What about when it comes to in-home and community care?
Yeah, we are also lower there. We have fewer workers compared to the senior population than most other countries, and so it is something that we would need. We do still have a challenge and need to address. Really, what I was trying to highlight is that we might not be able to fill that gap with enough healthcare workers. We need to actually be strategic and maybe think about expanding who we consider to be part of the care network or the potential supports that seniors have. And where possible, actually transition the labor away from the healthcare worker to something else so that the few healthcare workers we have can really focus at what they're best at and practicing to the limit of their scope, because that's what's more satisfying for them and also makes the best use of their time, their limited time.
Right back to that idea that you don't necessarily need a nurse to be cleaning up after someone or something at a certain dollar value. You could be turning that over to somebody who would be more cost efficient in that department.
Yeah, well, and really what I was looking at here is also just because there is, we really are facing a triple challenge. We have an aging population that has growing care needs. We have a shortage of capacity in long-term care and in hospitals. And there's limited fiscal room to actually address these problems. And then even add to that, the vast majority of seniors would rather age in their homes or at least a home-like environment, maybe like an apartment building or a retirement home type setup, as opposed to, say, a more institutional long-term care. Now, there are both long-term care and retirement homes that are set up, say, condo style. So there's lots of options across the country, and it might look a little bit different. But I would point out that in some places, the wait lists are worse than others, and the fiscal room might be different. So as well as the support policies. So each province should really look at what its major challenges are and potentially tailor policies towards that. Just to dive into it a little bit, I'd point out that in Ontario, particularly, then there's more than 70,000 people receiving care in long-term care, but the wait list currently sits at about 43,000. So even if we were to bring many more LTC beds online, it might not even be sufficient to address the current wait list, let alone the growing population. And so we really do need a cultural shift away from sort of the highest level of care towards doing as much prevention as possible and helping people to maintain independence, mostly because it's what they want and will best serve their needs. But it also has the added benefit of reducing the long-term wait list by preventing people from going there, and the same with acute care in hospitals.
So how do we achieve that cultural shift?
Well, as this is a multi-pronged problem, it's also a multi-pronged solution. I think that there's definitely some things within the healthcare system that we could look at, particularly incentives that drive towards that higher level care. And for example, when someone is in an acute care bed, a bed-to-bed transfer to LTC is administratively simpler. And hospitals in most provinces also have the ability to recoup some of the costs of those ALC patients when they are destined for long-term care. If they aren't destined for long-term care, however, the hospitals can't recoup those costs. So there's sort of a subtle implicit incentive to recommend a higher level of care in the medical space that is already risk-averse and cautious in terms of what it will recommend. They'd recommend what they think is, you know, potentially more than needed as opposed to less, simply because, you know, they want to make sure that patients have their needs met. So just sort of, I think there's some things within the system that we could certainly look at for changing the incentives as a way to start changing the culture. And beyond that, I think provinces should target really across policy areas, target a home first strategy for seniors. And that can include things like tax credits that could potentially make access to retirement homes or the affordability of rental housing easier for low-income seniors. It could also potentially incentivize wealthier seniors that can afford to pay for some services on their own to invest in their own care and take prevention seriously. And so I think part of it is socializing the idea, and part of it is looking at the various policies and incentives throughout the healthcare system, but also those that support housing and seniors in general, to kind of see how we can come up with a cohesive strategy that starts shifting things towards a home first strategy instead of what we have now, which is really a habit or maybe a past dependence that heads towards the status quo of putting people into long-term care homes or hospitals. And really, that's not what any of us want.
When it comes to the overall issue that we've been discussing, you touched on Ontario as an example of what's going on there. How much of the solution to this problem, when we think about it, is across the board? Or are some provinces doing better than others when it comes to this issue?
Well, I'd say some provinces are doing better than others on particular parts of the issue, but there's certainly learning, I think, that could be done by looking across provinces at the different nuances. So one thing I would highlight is that Quebec actually does support or does subsidize rent for lower income seniors, actually up to what you could consider to be a reasonably high income level. And so I think just sort of talking across provinces, Ontario could potentially learn from some of Quebec's tax policies to look at how its retirement homes and community care fill out the continuum, because we actually just have fewer spaces in Ontario and they're way more expensive than in Quebec. And I think that part of that is related to a subsidy actually helps stimulate the market there. And so for seniors who rent in Quebec, moving to a retirement home doesn't actually look like it increased your cost of living very much, but that's not true in Ontario. And then on the flip side, you could potentially argue that, you know, maybe subsidizing people that have, or couples that have an income over $200,000 up to $55,000 in costs. So we'd be subsidizing spending that's a pretty respectable level of income. You know, maybe there's a way to look at those and readjust so that those that might not need so much support then invest more into their own care. And I'd also maybe point out that in BC, they have, I would say, a combined market and geared to income mechanism for assisted living homes, where the room and board is determined based on market rent in the area so that retirement homes know what their revenues might be. But those that have lower incomes are then qualify for a subsidy, which makes it more equitable to access those services. So I think there's different strategies across the country that use different mechanisms, and each province should work with what it has, but take the best pieces from the other provinces and try and integrate those into their existing system.
Because healthcare is a provincial purview, is there a role for the federal government in this? And I ask that knowing full well that when the federal government tried to address the national housing crisis, which again is a provincial and municipal thing, some provinces were not too keen on Ottawa sticking their nose into their provincial business. Is there something that the federal level can be doing to help resolve this $3 billion a year that we seem to be wasting?
Directly, I would say the maybe unsatisfying answer is not really, because this is a housing issue and a healthcare issue for the most part, and so it would have the same sort of, shall we call them, political hurdles to overcome that federal involvement on provincial issues comes with. However, there are federal supports as well and federal tax policies to support seniors. And so I think they have within their own set of policies, there could be, there could be some optimization that could be done or some additional support. As well, I think we have a set of long-term care standards. So I think the federal government does have a certain role to play in maybe laying out frameworks or sharing best practices amongst provinces across the country. I guess being a coordination hub as opposed to necessarily getting directly involved in the policies themselves, at least in this case, given that they are complex, interrelated, and predominantly provincial issues.
So if our provincial health ministers were listening to this conversation, what's the one thing you want them to take away from our time together?
I would say the solution to our long-term care wait lists is not just build more long-term care homes, because that is just more of the status quo, and we'll never have enough of them to actually meet the current demand that we have. And so we need to think about other solutions. So all the cards should be on the table and try to think creatively and outside of the normal scope of healthcare to think about what are the real needs of seniors, what are the outcomes you want to achieve, and design the policies around that. And I bet you'll find it isn't build more long-term care homes.
Rosalie, thank you as always for your time and insight.
Always happy to be here and always happy to share.
Rosalie Wanch is a senior policy analyst at the C.T. Howe Institute. You can read her full commentary, Scenarios for Seniors Care, Future Challenges, Current Gaps, and Strategies to Address Them at cthowe.org. I'm Michael Hainsworth. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the C.T. Howe Institute podcast with Michael Hainsworth. Subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. The C.T. Howe Institute is an independent, not-for-profit research institute whose mission is to raise living standards by fostering economically sound public policies. The Institute is widely considered to be Canada's most influential think tank and a trusted source of essential policy intelligence, distinguished by nonpartisan, evidence-based research and subject to definitive expert review. Visit cdhow.org and follow us on Twitter and LinkedIn. Thank you.